Good evening, everyone. Let's start with our motivation. So if we think about all the causes and conditions that have come together for us to hear a review of Chapter 7 taught by Venerable Thupten Chodron, these causes and conditions are endless. Thousands, perhaps millions of causes. So we can think about how it is that we became interested in the Dharma. Most of us were not raised in a Buddhist country, and yet, at some point in our lives, we discovered the Dharma, we discovered Venerable Thupten Chodron. But then if we keep going back from Venerable Thupten Chodron's life, and all the things that she had to do, and all the teachers that she met in Asia, all the intense, sincere, devoted study that she invested in the past so that she could deliver these teachings so clearly. If we just keep tracing back from all of these points, it's just mind-boggling. And so we can really rejoice that we're in a situation right now that we can again listen to these teachings on Chapter 7. At this moment, we're not in a situation where we're in a country that's at war. We're not refugees. We're not lying in a hospital bed. We have everything going for us in this moment. And as we all know, our circumstances can change in a heartbeat. So let's take this opportunity to really direct our minds to thinking deeply about these teachings, knowing that it will certainly help us in developing a good heart, and it is also heading us in the direction of full awakening, which is the state that we're all wanting to attain so that we can be of benefit to all sentient beings. So Venerable Chodron is away on the East Coast giving teachings, and she will be back next week to continue with Ayadeva's teachings. And I'm just going to dive in because there's a lot of material to cover, and Venerable Tarpa is hoping that this will take more than one more week, but we're just going to shoot for it tonight, Venerable Tarpa. So we're starting in on verse 156. And our friend Joe Blow, or as I would like to say, most of us, ask the question, or we pose this idea that, well, as long as scriptural texts exist, there will be spiritual friends and oral transmissions of them. One may therefore try to end worldly existence in other rebirths. So what's so striking with all of these verses in this chapter is I can see that everything that I was raised to believe gets addressed, and everything gets blown out of the water, and it's just so amazing. So the actual wording for 156 is, most people cling to an unwholesome direction. Thus, certainly, most common beings go to bad transmigrations. So Aryadeva says, it is proper to feel aversion toward good rebirths, just as one does toward bad ones. So when I read this initially, I thought, what? 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 And it's very difficult, Aryadeva says, to be a proper listener. Most people are born in unfortunate rebirths. But then Joe Blow keeps raising this argument. Well, the texts are here. Somebody can read them. Someone can give us the transmission. We can do it in the next life. No worry now. Let's just take it easy. And Aryadeva says, most people cling to an unwholesome direction. And because of that, most certainly common beings go to bad migrations. This idea of I'll do it in another life, that's assuming that without making any effort at all, we'll have a whole sequence of good lives ahead of us. And Aryadeva says, since our minds are filled with ignorance, anger, and attachment, certainly most common beings do go to bad migrations because they create the causes for more and more suffering due to their uncontrolled mind. In thinking about this idea of, well, you know, the texts are there, you can do it in another lifetime, it occurred to me that there's so many people who are in such fabulous, not so many, there's a number of people on the planet right now that are in fabulous worldly situations. And so I was thinking about some movie stars that get paid, you know, $20 million a picture. They, you know, they have a career lined up. There's years and years ahead of them for making movies. They're on everyone's want list. You know, they're on advertisements for perfumes and cars. You know, there's just endless numbers of people wanting to meet them. And if I was in this situation, just think how hard it would be to, you know, put that aside when everyone is clamoring to be in your company and to give you all this money and to come to the Abbey and get on the chore rota and learn how to do dishes like we do them and share a room with two other people that you don't know, you know, and get your laundry done once a week. And it gets hung out in the line. It gets all stiff and hard. And so, you know, if I was a movie star and I had those choices, $20 million a picture, you know, for the next 20 years I'm lined up, studying the Dharma, trying to transform my mind. If I knew a little bit, I'd say, you know, all these people like Venerable Children, they're going to come back in a future life. They'll be around next time too. I'll meet them then. But I've got all this stuff to do, you know, so there's no worries. So I can see how a person in that situation would find that almost ridiculous to consider. And then Venerable Chogyam goes on to say that although texts and their proponents may exist, it is so difficult to be a proper listener because most people cling to the 10 non-virtuous pathways of action, and so we're destined for an unfortunate rebirth. And then Venerable Chogyam said, you know, when we look carefully at the 10 non-virtues, are there any of them that we haven't done? You know, and so if we list them, you know, killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, idle talk, covetousness, malice, ill will, wrong views. Well, we know for a fact we've done them repeatedly. And Venerable Chogyam also points out that when we do negative actions, we do them really well, usually. Really well. We've got it all laid out. We have the object of our intention really clear. And then this intention is combined with an affliction. We do the action really well. We do it meticulously. And afterwards we rejoice and we feel happy. And with that, we're set up. Not for a pure land, I don't think. So she says, you know, really look at this and look at those 10 non-virtues and don't blow it off as some kind of, oh, that's what I did when I first met the Dharma. I've studied that, I've done a little bit of purification, now I'm going to go and do the really important stuff like Tantra and get enlightened quickly. And she's saying that we have to really, really look at these over and over again and keep purifying and see the situation that we are in. And then she says, also look at the number of beings there are in these different realms. Well, even in the human realm, well, in this realm that we're in, the desire realm, and all the creatures that we see roaming the Abbey grounds. Big and small. And then I thought it would just be interesting to do a little bit of reading about what's below the surface of the water, for example. And the planet Earth is mostly covered by water. And the current estimates by researchers doing this kind of marine research is that between 700,000 and 1 million species live in the world's oceans. And it's also estimated that between a third or two-thirds of those creatures have yet to be named and described. So there's a lot of life in the water that we don't even know about, we haven't seen, there's no name for it. This is where we could end up, and that's on little planet Earth. And then there's these endless other universes that we can imagine, but we don't really know about. And in relation to this, many people here have have heard me talk about this quote from Venerable Robina, but when she said it years ago, it just got me in such a way. And she was giving the teaching on the Lam Rim at Milarepa Center, and she did the whole Lam Rim in one weekend. And at one point, this one man who was there burst into tears. She was teaching on the lower realms and how we get ourselves into the lower realms. And up until this point in his life, he had been a fisherman. And so he just saw the reality of what he was doing, and he just fell apart. And she was absolutely so skillful. She was so kind to him. And she just really brought him around very quickly. And her ending statement to this man and to all of us is that, you know, if we really knew how hard we have worked to get here, to get into this human life, meeting the Dharma, we would weep. We would just weep. And when this man heard that, I mean, his whole disposition changed, and he could see, you know, there was some hope, that he wasn't, you know, headed straight for a hell realm. But it is true, I think, if we really knew what we've done in the past, this complacency that I know that I fall into would not be happening. It just wouldn't happen. To think that, oh, I'll do it in a future life, that's just insanity. So given the fact that it is difficult for the conditions to come together of being a good listener, having the teachings on suchness, emptiness, having contact with a Buddha through our teachers who has taught the Dharma, we should definitely make effort to hear the teachings while all these conditions are there. When we have the opportunity to listen to teachings, we need to see this as extremely rare. And even when we're in a bad mood, we should do everything we can to put the teachings into practice. So moving on to verse 157, Joe Blow, who represents all of us, says, well, although bad rebirths must be avoided because they are states without freedom, full of many kinds of suffering, one need not feel aversion toward good rebirths since they're happy states. And that sounds pretty reasonable, actually. And Aryadeva says, actually, Joe, you've got it wrong again. It is proper to feel aversion toward good rebirths just as one does toward bad ones. So verse 157 says, on earth, the maturation of ill deeds is seen to be only deleterious. Thus, to the wise, the world appears similar to a slaughterhouse. So, for ordinary beings on earth, the maturation of ill deeds is seen to be harmful. I think to most of us, we see it in kind of a subtle way. But for the wise, they see how easy it is for us to have horrible rebirths. They see the world as a slaughterhouse. You live your life. We go through so much effort to get what we want. We may or may not make it to old age. And we do all these things to just grab that next moment of pleasure. We want to be loved. We want to be liked. We want to be successful. We want to have a career. We want to have a big family. We want to have friends. We want to have it all. So we get all those things in place. And then at a certain point, we don't know at what time, the consciousness separates from the body, and then our family has a corpse, and then there's a memorial service, and then we're off to the next adventure. So, that's what we have in cyclic existence. And then, at this point, Venerable pointed out that when we're in the situation where our grandparents have left, maybe now our parents have left, and now that veil that sort of protects us from thinking about death, that veil is certainly removed, and most of us see now that, oh, I'm sort of next in line. And that's quite a wake-up call. But I find, too, even in my case, that wake-up call changes in intensity. And when things are going a bit better, that sort of gets a little bit dimmer. And when I get it again, it gets really intense. But it's just not always there. So, as we know, the remains of polluted karma debilitate even those in good rebirths. And how, you might ask, does that happen? Well, we can be born with defective senses, we can have deformed limbs, we're born in poor countries, we're born in countries at war. You name it. You can just look at everything in the New York Times, whatever newspaper you're reading, people get born into very challenging circumstances. And this is going to be true for us too, unless we're practicing. And all these obscurations are karmic results. They're unwanted results. So Aryadeva says, don't think that a good rebirth is fine. The human realm, as we know very well, is still filled with extreme suffering. There are so many ways of being reborn into this extreme suffering. And those who are rich, for example, don't think about the future, but create negative karma. And out of that, they experience the maturation of that negative karma, first of all, by going to a hell realm. And after that karma has ripened in the hell realm, then when they're born as humans, they may experience different difficulties. And this doesn't apply to the rich, but we often think, as Venerable points out, that the rich are sort of exempt from this, but it's just anybody. When we create negative karma with all the factors complete so that they become a propelling karma, first that karma ripens as the birth, the realm you are born into. When that's exhausted as that effect, then another karma will ripen, maybe as a human. But you still have parts of that negative karma that are yet to ripen. And perhaps they'll ripen when we are human. And this will come in the form of problems or chronic illnesses, some kind of impediment. And it ripens then as a completing karma, giving some other situation in a human life. So Venerable Children says, really, don't get smug and secure and think right now it's okay. It's so difficult for us to get our complacency shaken. And at this point, she starts talking about the necessity of developing wisdom fear. And then Venerable goes on to explain that a better translation for this word fear is actually awareness of danger. And what that means is we are aware of the potential to experience suffering. And being aware of that potential, we want to avoid creating the causes for it and to purify the causes that we have already created. So, without this wisdom fear, or this awareness of the potential of danger, you know, we can just go along with our idea of there's all this time that we have. Someone calls us on the phone and says, do you want to go to this great movie? It's a documentary. You know, it's important. You should see it. It's been given all these Golden Globe Awards. And the hook is there. Because we think, yeah, this is going to be interesting. I can do my practice when I get home that night. And we know what happens then. We get home, we've gone for a coffee after the movie that was so important, and then we're practicing the next morning, but we have to go to work, and on and on. So we have to hear the teachings again and again, to think about them, to meditate on them, to break through this incredible layer of ignorance that keeps us falling off this promise to practice. So Venerable says, to get this awareness of danger, this wisdom fear, we don't have to be scared. Because this panicky, freaked out feeling is not at all what we want to cultivate. We know how to do that. This is not the point of it. But the point is to get the fact that, yes, I'm scared. This knowledge of what could happen is getting my attention, but when we have the wisdom fear, this awareness of danger, then we know there's something that we can do. We can abandon negative actions. We can do purification. We can create a lot of merit. We can study and meditate on the teachings. That's the kind of mindset we want to have, not this sort of deer in the headlights. Oh, no. You know, I've done all these things. Verse 158 starts off with a question. If the wise see worldly existence like a slaughterhouse, why do ordinary people feel no horror? And the answer is, from Aryadeva, they are as insane as a mad elephant. And then the question is, well, insane in what way? So 158, if one is insane because one's mind is unstable, what wise person would say that those in worldly existence are not insane? So this whole point of verse 158 shows us that to remain in cyclic existence out of attachment is insanity. Our minds are unstable. And the definition of insanity is no discernment, no discriminating awareness. Our mind is like a mad elephant. So a few weeks ago, I think Venerable Trini gave a BBC about what elephants are like, and I did a bit more reading about mad elephants, just to get the flavor of this. So as you probably know, elephants are famous for their incredible memories and their superior intelligence. In addition, though, they have become notorious for their violent rage and sometimes fatal outbursts. So as I read you more about elephants, I think we should be very wary about if we have this tendency and what kind of creature we could be reborn as if we don't curtail this kind of outburst. So the elephant's strength and affinity for rage make them one of the most potentially dangerous animals in the world. Apparently, if you're in a situation where you're around elephants, if you start to see an elephant rock, you're in trouble. Now, this might be true of humans, too. But anyway, they sort of signal this change in behavior by rocking. And then, it goes on. This article goes on to say that this is true of both wild elephants and elephants in captivity. But this kind of behavior is more common in elephants that are kept in a zoo or a circus because of the excessive frustration that they feel in being bound and kept in these tiny areas and often abused. But in India and Africa, elephant bulls have been known to attack entire villages, killing people and destroying rural homes. Presently, elephants kill up to 200 people a year in India and up to 50 in Sri Lanka. So the elephants have a remarkable memory, and many of these killings are inflicted upon villages that were involved in mass culling even decades prior to the attacks. So this is quite something, that they can retain this memory and they know who to get. Another possible reason for these attacks is revenge. As noted, elephants have a memory that rivals almost all other creatures. They've been known to remember those that have hurt them or helped them years after the fact. After extended periods of poaching and culling, elephants suffer post-traumatic stress disorder from witnessing the slaughter of their families and young ones. And so, this triggers the killing and the rampage. So we can see that humans do this. We can see where some humans, if they haven't done any purification or practice, that's probably the rebirth that they're heading to. And so, in thinking about all this, when we think that samsara is cool, then there's no urge to get out. And Aryadeva says, isn't this crazy? Compared to what the Aryas see and know with their own wisdom, what we think is important to an Arya is so stupid. And it's real insanity. And if we look at our views on other things, where we think things are permanent and they're not, or there's a real me that's in danger, I have every right to attack them back, seeing everything as permanent and stable and secure is how we see everything, and this is just crazy. And then Venerable Children goes on to say that another way that we're crazy is thinking that if I get my way, I'm going to be happy. So at the time she gave this teaching, she asked us to all reflect on the times that we've gotten our way and what came of that. And I think we've all had enough time on the cushion to know that when we've gotten our way, there might have been some brief moments of satisfaction, but instantly it shifts and changes, and there's probably other things that came that we're not expecting and brought even more unhappiness. Verse 159, the pain of walking one sees decreases when doing the opposite. Thus the intelligent generate the intention to end all action. So verse 159 is about the Duke of Change. You need to stop the process of creating polluted karma and stop the afflictions that make the polluted karma ripen by breaking the continuity of all polluted karma. Then when we've done this, the dukkha stops. From ignorance come the afflictions, which create the karma to be born in samsara. When all the different parts are complete, then it creates a throwing karma that is capable of generating a new rebirth. When we're able to stop the karma by stopping the afflictions, by stopping the ignorance, then the rebirth stops. Alternatively, we may have a lot of karma in our mind that could easily be ripened by craving and clinging, the eighth and ninth links. But if we stop the craving by eliminating the ignorance, then that karma can't ripen and throw us into a samsaric rebirth. So, for example, the arhats may have many karmic seeds that could have ripened in a rebirth, but they are never going to ripen because the ignorance that has been removed completely, because that ignorance has been removed completely. So therefore, the links of craving and clinging can never arise. Then Aryadeva says, childish beings are like people on a long trip who suffer from exhaustion. Sentient beings traveling the roads of samsara and getting exhausted by it suffer from depletion of divisions, the store of virtuous actions. Sentient beings are called migrators. We go from this rebirth to that rebirth, from this realm to that realm, exhausted by the stress and dukkha of samsara, depleting the good karma that we do have. So Aryadeva says, stop the mind from going in the wrong direction because we care about ourselves. Verse 160. When a single effect's original cause is not seen, and one sees the extensiveness with regard to even a single effect, who would not be afraid? So verse 160 is about abandoning the cause, which is the polluted karma. The intelligent rid themselves of samsara by stopping this process of creating the polluted karma, or stopping the ripening of polluted karma. However, no one can perceive the original cause of one single effect. So, for example, if we look at this pair of glasses, you know, the numbers of causes that came together for these to be produced is just mind-boggling. You know, just the material alone. I think mostly it's made of plastic, except for the lenses. So at some point someone had to drill the earth and get the oil out of the earth. Dinosaurs had to die for there to be oil in the earth. Somebody had to make these. Probably they're made in a factory. Then there's metal. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. We can't find a cause for anything. One single cause. And when we start looking at things like this, that everything is conditioned, then everything feels unstable. At any moment, any conditioning factor could change, and then everything's going to change. So we can't understand where it all happened, and what is happening now is almost like an accident, because there are so many different possibilities, with all these different causes and conditions. How did this all come together? And in thinking about this teaching right now, it just brings to mind an event where a number of people experienced the same thing, more or less, like the Malaysian jet disappearing. And you know, when we think of all the causes and conditions that got each of those individuals on that plane at that time, you know, and that they probably experienced this same result in death, if that's what happened, and that two of those people got on the plane with stolen passports, and had security been doing their job, those people's lives could have been spared, but instead they got on the plane. You know, it's just mind-boggling how these things happen. And so I think it is quite shaking to look at how we can't find a single cause. There are all these causes. One cause changes. Everything changes. Just amazing. And then Venerable Children says, then take a look at your mind and all the causes and conditions of your mind, and one moment of mind producing another moment of mind, how we are conditioned by the views of our family and by society, how we're affected by the objects that we think of, everything that goes into making up one single experience or action. There's just no control here. There's just too many causes and conditions to keep track of. And then when we think of that, there's this beginningless continuity, and when we realize that even a single effect has limitless numbers of causes, then what childish person would not be afraid? Each individual cause is a conditioned phenomena. There's no controller in any of this process over any of these causes and conditions. Therefore, we should always feel aversion towards samsara and strive to liberate ourselves from this vast wilderness of samsara that is made difficult to cross by the thickets of ignorance that fails to comprehend its own continuity. Our ignorance cannot comprehend the continuity of ignorance. And if we just think of the limitless causes, for example, of a pot, then what happens when you think of the limitless causes of our lives in samsara? Everything that we have experienced before, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, up, down, you name it. So who wouldn't be afraid? And this fear that Aryadeva is pointing to is this wisdom fear, not a panicked fear, but just that I need to be careful. This is a serious situation. That kind of awareness of danger, when you're really aware of danger, your mind is going to be very clear. You're not going to be freaked out. You're not going to be grasping. You're not going to be self-grasping. And you're going to see this situation very clearly. Verse 161. Since all results will not definitely be achieved, and those that are will certainly come to an end, why exhaust yourself for their sake? So verse 161 is cultivating the awareness of danger by considering the effects of polluted karma, leading us to renounce cyclic existence and have the aspiration for liberation, which will lead us into putting energy into realizing emptiness in order to liberate ourselves. Aryadeva says, making effort to get objects of attachment would be worthwhile if we were definitely sure that we could get them, and also after we got them, that they would never decay. Then it makes sense to work for objects of attachment. And it would be worthwhile because we could get these things, they wouldn't go away. And if we look at our own experience, it just doesn't happen. We work so hard in samsara to get the things that we're attached to, but they change, circumstances change, our mind changes, and the whole thing falls apart. So Aryadeva says, here, think and meditate on the nature of reality, on dependent arising. There are so many hindrances. We have to work very hard, and then we get exhausted. And look how hard we have to work to get that relationship, that job, get that social status, get the power to win the argument, to prove that we're right. And are we always successful, even though we exert so much energy? So, with this, Venerable Trungpa said, well, you know, to get this and really get it, make examples in your life. And then think of all the times that you did get what you wanted, got the relationship, got the acknowledgement, had the love, had the appreciation, and then ask yourself, did that satisfy me? Did it give me total happiness? And even if it did give us happiness in the first moment, they decay in the next moment. Verse 162. Work done with effort effortlessly disintegrates once it is done. Though this is so, still you are not at all free from attachment to actions. So verse 162 is asking us to consider the seriousness of the karma created under ignorance. Again, doing all these things, getting the relationship, building a reputation, doing all this stuff, it requires so much effort. We get it momentarily, and then effortlessly it disintegrates. And without doing anything at all, it disintegrates. So when I was thinking about this verse, I was thinking about people like extreme athletes, Olympic athletes, ballet dancers, and all of the work that goes into that kind of endeavor. And moment by moment, it disintegrates. But the effort is so huge. And when I was thinking about ballet dancers, I had the opportunity in my early 20s to meet this person who was a ballet teacher called David Adams. And at that time, I didn't know that when I was born, he was a superstar in Europe. He was Canada's biggest name. And yes, Canada produces ballet dancers, not just hockey players. And he was a huge superstar. He started off with the Winnipeg Ballet. He got a scholarship to go to England. He danced at the Sadler Wells Ballet. They started the National Ballet back in Toronto. He was lured back. He had a huge career there. They wanted him back in England. He went there. He was huge. He had a magnificent body, I must say, looking at his early pictures. He was just, you know, completely in control. Everybody wanted him. His body could do whatever he asked it to do. And he had a long dance career with this incredible strength. And then something changed in England. A love affair fell apart. He came back to Canada, started teaching ballet, but by this time he's about 50, you know, and your dance career is over. But he continued teaching and he was famous. And then, you know, the biggest cruelty of all, he has a stroke. And so this person that had this magnificent control of his body is wheelchair bound. And he received the Order of Canada. I can't remember when. It was long after his dance career was over. And he couldn't travel to Ottawa to get the award. So the Governor General at the time, Adrian Clarkson, came to Stony Plain, Alberta, and gave him the award at his home. And then he died. But, you know, to have that life where your body, I mean, for sure, I'm sure he thought his body was him. I mean, who wouldn't in that situation? But to have your body at that, you know, peak of performance, and then to have it go, I can't imagine the suffering. I know from a few people that he didn't have a spiritual practice, so I think the last years were filled with pain and with a great mental suffering, seeing it all disintegrate effortlessly. So, if we continue to create the karma that keeps us trapped in samsara, we should be very wary. And instead, we should be busy creating the actions that will bring a happy result in our being free of samsara. Following objects of attachment mires us more in samsara. And if we don't see that now, if we spend some time thinking about our choices so far, we will see this is true, and Aryadeva's statement here is, accomplish the path. So Joe Blow asks the next question. Though actions which require exertion do perish, one cannot free oneself from attachment to them because they're a source of pleasure. So verse 163 in response to that is, there is no pleasure in relation to either the past or the future. That which occurs now too is passing. Why do you weary yourself? So verse 163 is all about the inappropriateness of attachment to polluted karma actions on the grounds that they cause pleasure. So you might think, well, how can I possibly give up sense pleasure deluxe? How could I possibly give up Häagen-Dazs caramel ice cream or peach crumble? And initially the thought comes, why would I? Why? If it gives me some pleasure now, there's all this suffering going on in my life. I'm going to grab the stuff I can get right now. Or I can't give it up. Just habitual, I like that ice cream, I can't do it. But, of course, when we spend time on the cushion looking at sense pleasure deluxe, what we see is that it's fleeting, and if it is pleasurable even for a few seconds, it can't last. And it's not something now. It is not something that is going to be of benefit now or in the future. Aryadeva says, there's no pleasure in relation to the past or the future. There's no pleasure in relation to past events because they're over and done with. There's no real pleasure in future events that cause pleasurable states of mind because they haven't happened yet. The present moment of pleasurable feelings and the events that are causing them are decaying in every split second. So why weary yourself trying to get samsaric happiness? When you examine pleasure in the past, present, and future, you can't find any pleasure that is really there. Past things are gone, no pleasure there. Future things haven't happened, no pleasure there. Present things are going out of existence in each moment, no pleasure there. what are we trying to get and what are we clinging on to? So I'm sure that many of you have had the experience of going to a rock concert and all the planning that had to happen to go to a rock concert. So when I thought of this verse, I thought of the time in my 20s when my friends and I were so pumped about going to see Fleetwood Mac. And this was a huge deal. And this was months of planning. And somebody decided to get in line at Ticketmaster. This was before internet, of course. And I think our friend got there at about 3 in the morning to be the first person in line. Well, she was about 100 in line. But anyway, our friend got the tickets and we were just celebrating. And so, you know, we've all got the tickets and we get... the next big thing is how to get to downtown Calgary where the concert is. And, you know, we didn't have a car, so we had to go in public transit, but we knew the buses would be filled because everyone in Calgary was going to this concert. So all of that had to be figured out. And so then we get to the place where it was happening. I think it was the Saddle Dome. No, it was outside. Sorry, it was some football field. And lo and behold, the tickets that we paid so much money for were lousy tickets. We're way in the back. Like, the stage was sort of like a little thing way in the future, you know, way in the distance. No one had binoculars. And it was a beautiful day, but it was extremely hot. It was really hot. So then we start baking in the sun, waiting for the Fleetwood Mac concert to start. And then, of course, finally, you know, it starts. And the warm-up band is really lousy. It's really bad. And they went on way too long. And then by the time Fleetwood Mac starts, you know, it's sort of getting to be dusk, and we didn't realize it was going to cool off so much. And then the mosquitoes come. And it was very clear that everyone in the band was really crabby and overtired. And they weren't into it at all. And there was just sort of like this glum look on everyone's... I mean, they played the music well, you know, but who knows, maybe it was a record. And they cut the concert short because they said they had to go to their next gig. And so it's like, really? This was meant to be a really good thing? And it was just, in the end, miserable. Like, actually, the whole thing was miserable. And we paid good money for it, too. So, no reliable happiness. Why exhaust yourself? All right. Now, I'm just checking the time. I don't want to miss this one verse. Okay, we're good so far. So, Joe Blow asks the question, or makes the statement, one should perform virtuous actions for the sake of a high rebirth. And verse 164 reads, the wise feel the same fear even for a high rebirth as for the hells. It is rare indeed for a worldly state not to produce fear in them. So 164, verse 164 is the way to abandon polluted actions. Create merit with the intention that you want a certain rebirth in the future. The appropriateness of having fear or an awareness of danger, since the Aryas see even the higher rebirths as a hell realm. So Joe Blow says, you know, well, we should do meritorious actions so that we can be rich in future lives and have high prestige and be attractive and have a wonderful family. So it's really good right now to work to create some positive karma and dedicate it all for that purpose now to have that kind of future life. Naturally, I used to teach with a person who was very sincere about being a very ethical person and very trustworthy and really, really a very good person. And he was determined that his next life, he was going to be a Japanese wealthy person. And that was his whole thing. I think that's still his story. A wealthy Japanese merchant. That's his goal. Aryadeva says that for an Arya, someone who has wisdom, they are just as afraid of a rebirth in a higher realm as they are in a rebirth in the hell realm. So initially, as we know, along the path, we're instructed to develop a sense of awareness of the danger of being reborn in the lower realms and to aim for a good rebirth. And then when we're further along the path, then we are ready to hear, don't just aim for a good rebirth, because that's a temporary situation. So we get some pleasure in the next life, but the good karma that causes it is exhausted, and then we wind up going down again into a lower realm. Or we keep cycling in cyclic existence again and again, chasing all these things that don't last in the long run. Even the good rebirths that we aim for in samsara out of attachment to the pleasure for example, wanting to be born in the God realm or the sense pleasure deluxe of the desire realm, wanting to be born in the form realm, in deep states of blissful concentration. Well, from the perspective of an Arya, those kinds of rebirths are ablaze with the fire of afflictions and shrouded in the darkness of ignorance, because the mind that has created the cause for them is still not free from ignorance. And seeing that produces an awareness of this fear or this awareness of danger for the wise. So then they don't just strive for a good rebirth for the sake of having a good rebirth. The wise really want to realize emptiness and to put their heart into understanding dependent arising. Okay, I'm going to move ahead to probably the most impactful verse of this entire chapter. It's verse 165. If childish people ever perceived the suffering of psychic existence, at that moment, both their mind and body would completely fail. And Venerable Chodron, when she read this verse, she said, you know, this is really true. If we really saw and got what cyclic existence is really all about, we would go crazy. That's why it requires so much purification and so much accumulation of merit to make our minds strong enough to bear seeing what samsara is really all about. For an ignorant mind that is attached to the wrong things, seeing that kind of thing is so opposite to what we believe and what makes us secure that if we saw it, we'd be thrown into pandemonium. So we need to strengthen our mind to be able to see, to be able to bear seeing the truth, to bear to see things as they actually are, even conventionally, because it is so opposite from the way our afflicted mind sees things. And to bring this point home, Venerable Chodron said, you know, think of it like this. Someone you've known for maybe most of your life, you know, you trust them with your life. At some point you find out that for all this time they've been lying to you. They've deceived you, it's been a big show. And just think of how you'd feel when you discover that you've been lied to. And I know this one very deeply through a person that was very close to me. My godmother was married to this man, and she had no idea that at some point in their marriage he started seeing another woman. And from there he had two children with this woman. And this was all happening in a small town. And the tragic part of this is that everyone in the town knew, except for my godmother. Now, she knew that she wasn't in a good marriage. She knew that. But she didn't know about the woman or the children. And then at some point, someone told her. And she absolutely disintegrated. She was a very devout Catholic. But there was nothing, you know, that she could hang on to that could protect her from this. And the first thing she did was she started drinking. And she started drinking a lot. And so I saw this person that I loved just, you know, be taken over by alcohol. And it was absolutely a horrific thing to see. And fortunately, all of her friends, including my mother, got together and they got her into a treatment program. And she got rid of the drinking habit really quite quickly. Because, you know, she was just doing this just to dull the pain and just to get away from this. And then she developed breast cancer. And from there, the breast cancer, you know, moved all over her body. And at the age of 56, she was dead. Now, I think, and this is just my personal view, but I think the pain of all that really, you know, lined her up to get this other illness. And that may sound like New Age thinking, but her broken heart was just, she was destroyed by it. So, the other thing I was thinking of is that when we see how life evolves for people around us, maybe our parents, maybe friends, and What I was thinking of is, let's say you're a parent and you're tucking your children into bed one night, and then you and your partner sort of collapse on the couch, and then this screen comes down, and on the screen is projected what's going to happen as your children age and as they, you know, go through life, all the things that happen to them, the circumstances about how they die, how they live. And if you saw that as a parent, you couldn't stand it. I mean, who could stand it? And so what this verse is pointing to is that we can't stand, we can't even hardly bear knowing about conventional reality and what's going on. We have to develop ourselves to get to the point where we can bear seeing what's going on in samsara. So Venerable says, if we really saw what samsara is, we'd be horrified. So Aryadeva says, we need to do a lot of purification and a lot of accumulation of merit, and that will give us the strength to do this. Okay. Well, I think I might go a little bit over time. I'm going to do two more verses for chapter 7, and the rest you can just investigate on your own. All right, verse 166. People without pride are rare, and the proud have no compassion. Thus it is said to be very rare to go from light to light. So this verse is about the rarity of going from happiness to happiness, the rarity of going from one good rebirth to another good rebirth. So Job Lowe says, being in the highest socioeconomic class, having fine possessions, is typically known as happiness. Let's go for it. Aryadeva says, it is appropriate to have aversion for that kind of result. And he goes on to explain that people who have worldly pleasure and status and who are not inflated by pride are very rare. The rich, the famous, the sports people, the movie stars, all these people in those categories, it's so easy to get inflated. And if we look at back on our own lives, and so how easy it is for us to be inflated with any kind of worldly success that we have. And when we're inflated and full of conceit, then it's so easy to create a lot of negative karma through negative actions, gossiping, lying, mistreating, and exploiting people, thinking that all the rules don't apply to us, and even if they do, I have friends and important people who can fix the situation. I am untouchable. Well, I'm going to share a story now about a person. I'm not going to give the name. And if you're Canadian, you'll know who it is. Some Americans might know it too. But this is a story that's showing exactly this. This particular individual was a very prominent Canadian. He was operating on both sides of the border with his very successful newspaper business. And he, at one point, really had it all, has a beautiful wife, incredible wealth, incredible power, respect in numbers of countries. He was conferred the Order of Canada in 1990, and this person was described at that time as a distinguished Toronto entrepreneur and a publisher, a man of diverse achievements within the realms of Canadian commerce, educational literature, and the arts. This individual was at the helm of a Toronto-based company that at one time was the third largest English language media empire in the world. He had it all. He could do it all. So it changed in a moment. In 2005, he was charged with 8 counts of mail fraud and wire fraud for allegedly looting millions of dollars from a publishing company he used to head. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago, because he was operating on both sides of the border, accused this Canadian and 3 others of this company of diverting money that should have gone to the company and its shareholders. The indictment alleges that this Canadian and the other defendants fraudulently diverted $51.8 million through non-competition agreements when their company sold most of its newspaper assets to another company. The U.S. authorities say U.S. and Canadian shareholders were cheated by the alleged fraud, as were Canadian taxing authorities. So the second scheme alleged by the authorities has this Canadian and his colleagues fraudulently misusing corporate perks, including two luxury apartments in New York, a company jet for a South Pacific vacation, and using $42,000 US of corporate funds to throw a lavish birthday party for this Canadian's wife. So he was busted big time. What he did at that point, and there was apparently another $80 million missing somewhere. So early on, because he had this power, he got hold of this really great lawyer in Toronto. His name is Edward Greenspan, who's really, really recognized, to act as his defense. But because he was being charged in the United States, this Canadian lawyer had to get American lawyers to help him out. So they got the best. I don't know if you know the names. They're very well-known criminal lawyers, Eddie Genson and Mark Martin. Anyway, they're the best of the best that year. To make a long story short, he ended up spending 42 months in prison. All of his assets were seized. At some point in time, he sort of divested himself of his Canadian citizenship because, you know, he preferred to be... He actually became an English lord. I think he still is an English lord. He didn't lose that title. But then in January of this year, he was stripped of the Order of Canada. So he's come back to Canada as a temporary resident. I don't know what he's living on. His wife is a famous journalist. But he had it all. And he felt like he was invincible. And poof, jail for almost 5 years. I'm going to skip ahead to verse 175, which is the last verse of chapter 7. For those who do not enjoy any objects in cyclic existence, it is altogether impossible to take pleasure in this world. So Arya Deva says, when we really see through the falsity of samsara, how things appear so alluring and enchanting, as if they had real happiness in them, so that when we get that thing, that situation, the relationship, the place, because it is inherently attractive and there's seemingly real happiness stemming from it, then we live happily ever after. And as Venerable Children says, living happily ever after in samsara is a fairy tale, but we believe it. Even the things that appear kind of desirable and alluring, they aren't. They're impermanent. They're decaying in each moment. They are the nature of being unsatisfactory. There's no happiness in them. They are created by our own ignorance and polluted karma. They make pollution arise in our mind. So what is there to cling to? When a person thinks like this, it is impossible to take pleasure in this world. So hearing this kind of thing, we might think, well, that's really depressing. That's, you know, what have we got here then? But that's not it. Someone who is depressed and someone who sees through the falsity of this alluring appearance of samsara, this is very different from a depressed person who is still craving for some kind of samsaric thing and is not getting it. So they're depressed. The other person we're talking about, a sincere Dharma practitioner, is no longer craving for anything in samsara. Their mind is relaxed, open, receptive. Whatever comes their way, they're content with it. They have a totally different state of mind. These people see that there are states of happiness far superior to anything in samsara, the state of liberation, the state of full awakening. From your own side, there is so much more bliss and fulfillment. And from the side of others, where you can do so much more as a fully awakened being for the benefit of others. So Arya Deva's parting advice is this. Having considered the disadvantages of sense objects, become wise with respect to the meaning of reality. Understand that dependently arising things lack true existence and strive to attain unsurpassable awakening by generating bodhicitta and thoroughly cleansing your mind by realizing the nature of reality. Thinking thoroughly about impermanence, dukkha, the nature of things being unsatisfactory, that they can't give us any lasting fulfillment or contentment. These things of samsara, having the thought about that, then giving up craving for objects such as visual form, give up the mind that says, I want to see beautiful things, I want everything arranged in a certain way, giving up craving for nice sounds, sounds of people saying ego-pleasing things, great music, good news, good cat food. Cut the craving for nice smells, give up craving for taste, give up craving for tactile sensations, having the room at a certain temperature, because all of this doesn't lead us anywhere in the long run. Instead, see it as a cause for this bottomless, boundless ocean of dukkha, and instead, strive to attain unsurpassable awakening. And as Venerable Children says, the most important gift you can give someone is telling them this. So I missed some parts of the chapter, but these teachings of Venerable's are online. You can check those out on your own. And let's really take to mind what Aryadeva says. There's nothing in samsara worth trying to grab onto, and let's really develop our minds for the benefit of all.
Due to this memory, we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore.